So I want to thank David Simons, who is the author of Studio Stories, which turns out to be more or less a tribute to Frank for the pictures and some of the audio that he sent us to use for the meeting tonight. Remove the barrier. Okay, I think it's yours, Dr. Mike.
Oh, thanks, Rick. Sorry, I've been kind of hopping around back and forth and so forth, wearing more than one hat. Well, it's our great pleasure this evening to have Frank Lako with us. We are so fortunate that Frank chose to move out to Edmonds less than 2 years ago. And this evening, as moderator of the evening, is going to be Tom Conrad, who most of you have already met through the previous meeting that we had here with Roy Dunan. Mm-hmm. And so without any big, long introductions other than to say that Tom is very skilled at this, as you've already, most of you have already witnessed, and whose deep-abiding ambition was to be really a involved in literature rather than what sales, but as it turns out, he was involved in sales many years, in fact, in one capacity or another with Magnolia Hi-Fi, which, again, most of us in the Northwest are familiar with, if not all of us. But anyway, without further ado, I'd like to introduce Tom Conrad, who is going to take over at this point.
Let me know, Rick, when we need to put these microphones on. Thank you very much. I want to thank Mike and Rick for inviting me back. I was here last November for the night honoring another great engineer, Roy Dunan, and had a wonderful time and met so many interesting people who share my passion for music and for good sound. And tonight we have another very special event, and I was delighted to be back here for it. What we have tonight really is a piece of living history that is so deep and so broad and so distinguished that we are going to have an impossible task to try to cover this extraordinary career in one night. I think what we're going to have to try to do is scratch the surface and hopefully scratch it in some right places. One thing I want to mention is that I know that you guys are going to have questions, and we absolutely will make time for your questions at the end. I'd ask that you hold them until then. Our plan, and we'll see if we stick to it, this is a lot of jazz music we're going to talk about tonight, so we're going to be improvising to a certain degree. We'll see if we stick to the plan, but we plan to get through our formal, if you can call it that, interview before the break, then have a break. We've been promised carrot cake, and then reconvene for your questions. There'll be some musical interludes also during the course of the evening. So that is our plan. It's hard to know where to start with a career like that of our special guest this evening. One place that's common to start when you're talking about a recording artist or a producer or a record label or an engineer is Grammys, if there are any Grammys in the portfolio. Those usually get mentioned. There are lots of Grammys in this portfolio, going all the way back to 1962, when a Grammy was awarded to an album engineered by our guest this evening, containing a song you just might have heard of called I Left My Heart in San Francisco, an album, of course, by Tony Bennett. That song became an absolute icon. It was on the top 10 charts for 3 solid years after it was made. It was, of course, Bennett's signature song. In 2001, the RIAA/NEA compiled a list of the most historically significant vocal recordings of the 20th century. That was number 23 on the list. I'm not sure what 1 through 22 were, but 23 isn't bad when you're considering all the vocal recordings of the 20th century. That was one Grammy. There was a couple Grammys in 1963, one for an album called The First Family. If you remember that album, then you're dating yourself like I am. I remember it. One comedy album of the year, of course. And also in 1963, something called the Barbara Streisand album, her first album, an enormously important recording in the history of American pop music in 1965, September of My Years by Frank Sinatra. I mean, the list goes on and on. But it isn't just about Grammys. It's about the list of artists with whom this engineer was associated. It's just mind-boggling. My field is jazz. I am now a freelance journalist and write for Stereophile and Jazz Times on jazz-related subjects. And it just continues to amaze me how many albums I trip over that were near and dear to me that were engineered by our guest tonight. Albums by Miles Davis, for example. Here's one that you might know, Porgy and Bess, a historic album in the history of jazz, one of the first collaborations of the great arranger Gil Evans, jazz interpretations of course, Gershwin's great operetta. Many other albums by Miles, including Bitches Brew, much further into his career, also a historic recording going in a different direction. Albums by Antonio Carlos Jobim, by Thelonious Monk, and I stumbled over a fact not long ago that the first album I ever owned in my life was this one. It was called Drum Suite, Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, recorded in 1957 in February by our guest this evening. Not only jazz, some pretty important pop like Aretha Franklin, Leonard Cohen, Bob Dylan, Highway 61 Revisited. It's an amazing list. Johnny Mathis. Johnny Mathis made, of course, huge selling albums that were in their era known as the quintessential makeout albums ever made. Age demographic profile of our audience here tonight, and just given our statistical sample, I think it's likely that there is at least one person here, it's statistically probable that there's at least one person here who lost their virginity while a Johnny Mathis album. We're not going to ask for a show of hands, but even that, you know, to a degree, we owe to our guests. And in the spirit of full disclosure, there's some stuff in there somewhat less artistically distinguished. We got your Bobby Vintons in there. There's a little Andre Castellanos, a little schmaltz. You guys got to make a living, right? There's some Connie Francis, etc. But the portfolio is amazing. And, of course, the historic importance of the artists is central here. But at the same time, what we're here to talk about a lot this evening is the consummate skill with which this music was recorded is what has preserved it even into our present day, and still, as I think you will hear some examples of tonight, still absolutely serves the music. So if you would please welcome one of the most important engineers in the history of the American recording industry, Frank Laco.
Yes, I am. Okay. Am I being heard?
All right. Yeah, yes.
Hopefully it'll continue that way.
As I said last time, this is the only interview I've ever conducted in my stocking feet. There was a picture in, I think, the AES most recent issue, was it? There's a picture, anyway, of the Roy Dernan night, so maybe it was an older, where I'm... Thank God I wore socks without holes because they're prominently displayed. A standard way to start is a bio, and since we've got Frank here, there's no point in my giving it. We should ask him to give us kind of a brief resume of the the high points, a few low points, if you'd like to throw any in, of your life.
It's all part of it.
Kind of some of the basics. We'd love to know about where you're from, how you got started, and so on.
All right. I did get started. Born and raised in New York City, and proud of it, by the way. It was a great place. The state of New York is so similar to Washington, I almost feel I haven't left, except for the kindness of all you folks. I know we didn't never give that back then. But anyway, everyone's been so nice and so complimentary, and I almost don't know that they're talking about me, but I thank you. So we got here, my wife and I got here 2 years ago, and unfortunately we haven't had a chance to really get around because I've had medical problems, and I think we're finally on the road to recovery. So I'm happy to be here, and I'm thrilled that you all think enough of a stranger to come in. Thank you. So, yes, I started in New York City, had no idea. I have a title of recording engineer. I appreciate that. I never had schooling for it. But I grew up through the depressions. And my dad and mom, God bless them both, had seven children. And I was the middle one, the fourth one. So when the depression came, Dad lost his business, and he worked all the time. Went through, I was in junior high school, my junior year, and I was asked to get out of school because money was needed to continue living. So I did, and my brother, older than me, the two of us, we went and did what we could to make it easier. But I must tell you truthfully that no matter, I knew it was depression, but if you were in we were in a house at that time, you would never have known it. My mom, God bless her, how she did it, none of us know, but we ate well every meal. We shared desserts. If it was an apple, it was cut four pieces, but we always had food. And with that kind of warmth and everything else, you do whatever you can to keep it going. And that's what we did. And I finally was working as a delivery boy and an apprentice butcher for a store about 10 miles away from home, to take the trolley car for a nickel back and forth. And I was working there a couple of years, and I was delivering orders and make them believe I'm an apprentice butcher. And one of the customers, both he and the wife, took a liking to me. I have to use that word. That's the way I felt. And he asked me if this was going to be my career. And I said, I certainly don't plan it to be. And I said, as a matter of fact, I thought that I wanted to go to Delahanty's. That's a school for police and firemen. So I inquired, well, I'm way up in the Bronx, and that's way downtown New York. And it starts at 7 o'clock, and I'm still working in that meat market at 7 o'clock. So I was at a loss. He said, well, I want to talk with you, so come to the house next time we order something and plan to stay a few minutes. So I did. And he said, I work for a recording company. I can't tell you too much about it because I'm the treasurer, so I don't know much about electronics. But anyway, I would like to help you if I can. If a job opens up, would you be interested? I said, of course I would. So a few weeks later, same thing. Bring this to the house and spend a couple of minutes. So I did. And he said, well, I have a job offer to give you. It's your choice. I have nothing to say about it. This is what it is. here's your appointment, here's the address, and this is the person you see. Okay, so I went, and it wasn't what I thought I was going to be doing or finding out about, but I was hired to be a mimeograph operator. What we were doing then was the start of the disc jockeys. World Broadcasting would record these masters, orchestras, chamber music, just everything. And then they would put it all together with the spoken word and mail it out to every city in the United States and Canada.
So this company was World Broadcasting.
World Broadcasting, yeah. It was a, so, anyway, after about a month or two, I realized there's no future in this, so I decided with free time, lunchtime, I walk around the different floors. And the first 2 days, I didn't hear a sound of music anywhere. And the third day, I lucked into it. Off in the distance, I heard music. So I followed my ears, and I had much better ears than those days. And I get to this door, and I went to open it, and I threw my back out. It was so heavy. And I look in, and here's these wax masters going around, 16-inch platters. And I hear the music, and I thought, my God, isn't this fascinating? So I poked my head in. I said, may I come in? Yes, you can come in, but don't let that door slam, because we're out of work if you do. I said, okay, so I got in there, and they were so nice to me. They answered every question I had, and I talked to them, and they were all older men. So as I had to leave, I said, is it possible for me to come back? You come back anytime you want. Just remember that door, and you cannot stamp your feet while you're in here. I was fine. So I did that, and after a few weeks, they were very, very nice to me. Polite, informative. I asked a question, they wouldn't say no or anything, they'd answer. And after a few weeks, the supervisor said, come on, I'll show you how we drop this cutter. It was a Western Electric cutter. And they were recording vertical and lateral in those days. So I did it. And the more I did it, the more it felt so good. And the fellow that was showing me how, I said, you got the right touch. I don't see any chips flying anywhere. He said, you do very well. So that continued. And after a while, I said to the supervisor, I said, you know, how can I get in here? I'd love to be working here. They're all so nice, and I'm finding it fascinating. He said, well, you have to go up and see the boss. Well, I'll cut it short. I went and saw the boss, who was unenthusiastic. And he said, nothing now, and I don't know when. We have enough, you know, the usual. But I kept going back. And after a couple of months, he called me and said, come up. And I went up. He said, I have a job for you but as an apprentice if you want to do it. I said, I want a job, and that's why I'm here. So he said, okay, you can start Monday. I said, fine. What are my hours? 9 to 5, okay. And, of course, nothing was mentioned about money, so I said, I thought I said that I needed to earn some money because my parents are in a bad spot. So I said, oh, okay. So I was making $15 a week running a mimeograph. He was very magnanimous. He said, I'll start you at 17. Okay, I'll start at 17. I'm not going to argue. What he didn't tell me was that they worked a lot of overtime. And when they worked overtime, they got paid overtime and also supper money. And here I am the first week every night working and going to supper, but no supper money. It's all out of my own pocket. And I went to him finally. I said, I can't afford it. I said, either going to treat me like the rest of your men. I don't expect you to treat me like an old-timer, but I want a little concern. I need money, and it's not for myself, it's for my parents. And it's costing me money. You keep assigning me at overtime, and I don't get paid overtime, and I don't get supper money. Well, all right, he said. We'll start you off. We'll give you supper money. No word about overtime. So that's how it started. And I kept getting more and more enthused. And I really was, I was happy. I've been happy from the first day I got into the recording business. And I'm still happy. I miss it so. It was such a joy for me to go to work. And I don't know about the rest of you, but unless you're happy when you go to work, work is work and nothing else. I used to work till midnight or later, get up at 7, because remember, I lived 80 miles out of New York City, so I had to travel in, and I'd get up, my wife would have breakfast, give me a sandwich for lunch, because most oftentimes you sit there while you're working to eat, and off I went. No complaint, she understood completely that that's what I wanted, and she never raised any doubt in my mind that she was 100% with me. And that's how it all started.
So when you were at World Broadcasting, Frank, I know that you got drafted in 1943.
Oh, I did, yes.
Now, between the time that you've had your first exposure to this,
yes,
to this cutting equipment, then you started to get into much more involved and learn a lot more prior to the time that you got drafted in 43 at World Broadcasting.
Oh, yes, yes. I was totally involved, and I was being also groomed to be a mixer. You all understand that, I'm sure. That was my dream right from the start. I didn't want to be, and I don't want to negate it, I didn't want to be in a room doing the same thing 8 hours every day. I wanted the challenge, and I wanted to be involved with people and musicians of the greatest people on earth. Believe it or not, they're the warmest, the friendliest people you could ever run into. And that's where I finally talked to my supervisor. I said, this is where I really want to be. And you said I would have a chance, so I'm reminding you. I don't know, not putting you under any pressure, because I know there are other fellows here before I came. He said, you're going to get it, don't worry. So he did. He started me off doing solo mic, a couple of musicians, maybe three or four, and just progressively kept getting better. We had all of a 6-mic position console when I first started, so you couldn't get too complex. And
now this is pre-tape days, of course, right?
Pre-tape,
you're,
yes,
recording onto
a disc.
Direct to disc, you know.
Well, at first it was wax platters, and then it went direct to disc. Glass, and then it was aluminum discs. And but it was every step of the way was a great challenge. I also felt whatever success I had was because of my enthusiasm, but also because I started monaural. And if you go into a studio to record and you had one microphone or two, whatever, you had to get the sound immediately, and it had to be recorded without goofs or mistakes and whatever, because once, if it did, then you had to start all over again. But it taught me what all instruments sounded individually, as well as getting them into groups. And that's such a necessary education. If any of you are interested in that kind of work, and by the time I got finished, I was recording symphony orchestras.
This is at World Broadcasting now?
Huh?
This is at World Broadcasting you were?
Oh, no, no. I'm going into the service.
World Broadcasting, prior to the time you were drafted in 1943, you were up to recording in mono, small ensembles,
yes,
huh?
Yes. So, yes, then I went to the Army. And the day I left Signal Corps, Army Signal Corps personnel came to World Broadcasting and said, we're going to take over facility. They wanted a room just about this very same size. And we want an engineer also of yours. So the boss, who always was picking on me, said, well, the man you want just left yesterday. He's on his way to camp up to Long Island. So he said, well, okay, give me his name, his information, if he left you his serial number, whatever, so I can contact him. And they did. I was in New Jersey, a basic camp, living in a tent, and it was colder than hell. And after a couple of weeks, I had called my sister, was the only one left at home. We were six brothers and one sister, and she was mom number two. And I called, and she said, are you in trouble? I said, no, why? She said, well, the FBI has been all over the neighborhood checking up, wanting to know if they know you and what kind of a person. I said, well, I haven't the faintest idea.
That is a little ominous. The FBI's been hanging around asking about you, yeah.
What's that?
It's a little ominous.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So I said, no, I don't know. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll be coming home in 2 weeks for my weekend leave, and I'll stop in at World Broadcasting on my way before I come home, and I'll check it out with them. And that's what I did. I went there, and he said, oh, of course, God, we're happy you're going to be coming back, and all of that. And I told him I was thrilled myself. So that's how I got into the Army, into the Signal Corps, and I was assigned to the very, very secret communication group that until 5 years ago, we were still sworn to secrecy. And then
still
they finally
classified until 5 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So they finally, 5 years ago, said, you can tell your wife, anyone you want, what you did. And that was the first time I was able to tell my wife. So, but speaking to Bob Smith back here, he knows all about that outfit. I didn't realize it. And
so basically, what was that?
It started when, if you ever were able to listen in, which we had to do, those records that we made for that group, there were only three pressings made, one for the Pentagon, where we were, second one went to wherever we were going to communicate with, and the third was held as a spare. So everything was done on schedule. So when we were going to meet or talk, we never saw the people that were talking because that was in a different area in the Pentagon. But we were given a schedule, and we had to stick to that schedule because those records that I made, each of them had to start exactly on the same time. And if you were listening on earphones, you didn't know what you were listening to. There was no voice. It was all electric sounds, buzzers, just anything. Bell Labs had designed this system. And we were so successful, U.S., that it was never broken into. We had broken into the Germans, the Italians, Japanese, but this system was never, never broken into.
This encode, decode system.
Yes, absolutely. And it was so successful that once we had a chance to really think of what we accomplished, we realized that the war was shortened by a fair amount of time because of instant commands were carried out instead of flying into Washington and flying back to the theater of operation. So we all felt real proud of ourselves when we realized what we had accomplished during that period of time.
That's an extraordinary you know, a little sort of sidebar to the story that I thought was important to get told. So, you know, we probably should move to kind of more of the you know, the central subject matter of the evening, and what happened immediately after, or soon after the Second World War, when Frank got out. You know, one of the reasons why the Frank Laco story is so important is because he became associated with the record label that is the most important American record label in the history of the industry, and that's Columbia. Those of you who are younger in the audience may not necessarily think of Columbia in those terms now in 2008, but in the 50s, 60s, 70s, it was a dominant label, and that's where Frank went to work. Back in the day, the record sleeves of those LPs probably rarely, if ever, identified the engineer. They rarely identified the recording studio and so on. One of the reasons why Frank's legacy has been preserved with such extraordinary faithfulness and quality is because of a reissue program called Columbia Legacy. Yeah. I don't know how many of you have seen Columbia Legacy stuff. Again, I was mentioning my field is jazz, and they just do beautiful stuff. These slipcase sets with, you know, metal containers, six CD sets. These happen to be a couple of Miles Davis compilations, all or mostly material engineered by Frank. And it's probably was in the reissues that I first encountered Frank's name, because in these reissues, they're very scrupulous about identifying dates of recording, who engineered each track, all kinds of recording information. And so it was through Columbia, of course, that Frank was associated with so many of these great artists. How did you get started at Columbia, and how did you get started there, really taking responsibility for engineering recording sessions?
Well, let's go back to when I was working at World Broadcasting, and I was in the cutting room, and CBS didn't have any studios or facilities to record. So they through the telephone lines, their studios were fed into World Broadcasting, and we picked the audio up off these phone lines, and I was assigned to record those master discs for CBS, Columbia Records. So while I'm doing that, the supervisor for Columbia would be alongside me watching me work. And so finally, when I was leaving and I told him I was, well, he said, "Now listen, Frank, hear me. Don't forget, when you get out of the service, you'll have a job with Columbia." So I thought, that's very nice, and I appreciate it, and I thanked him. Lo and behold, when I got out of the Army, I went back to World, thinking that's where I should go. And I'm here, and I can start whenever you want. Oh, how about Monday? I said, sure. I said, but, you know, there's an issue that we haven't talked about, salary. You remember that? We discussed it a lot. Oh, yes. What were you earning when you left? I said, $40 a week plus overtime and meal money. Okay, well, that's fine. We'll start it that way. And I looked at him. I said, oh, 3.5 years have gone by. Are you joking? The guys, it's a union shop. They're doing a whole lot better than that. Well, that's it. And I said, well, thank you very much. You've been very, very good to me. I appreciate everything that I learned from your company, but I'm not going to come back. So I didn't. And I kept bouncing around. I must have taken 6 different jobs. I was the first engineer at the United Nations when they hadn't even started anything. And I'm up at the Girls College in the Bronx, sitting there doing nothing. No word of doing anything. And after 3 weeks, I handed my resignation. He couldn't understand it, but I did that 5 or 6 times, and finally I decided, well, let me go back and see what Columbia's going to offer. So I went, and he was kept his word. In fact, my greeting was, well, you finally got here. So I looked at him. I said, did you know I was out? He says, I certainly do. I can tell you every place you've been.
So 1946, 1947?
This was 46.
Still 46, yeah, so right yeah. After, okay.
Summer of 46. I started July 1st at Columbia in 46. And I went through, you guys, those days we didn't have the opportunities you all have today, where you can drop a job and pick another one up the next day. Man, I stayed with them. I had job offers, but I was so in love with the acoustics in that abandoned church that I turned down a few offers that paid me more money, but I knew I could never be happy in it. Oh, I don't want to upset you, but that's just what the kind of studios that they asked me to, I know. So, but this, I'd love to be in here someday and hear it. But anyhow, so I stayed with Columbia, and I was happy. I had all these great artists, not only, well, I guess a little bit of ego too. They were requesting me to record them. So I felt real great, and I enjoyed them. And I became part of the music industry completely. I told you, I did Tony Bennett's audition. I recommended him to Mitch Miller. Mitch Miller signed him, and I did Tony's first records, and I kept recording Tony right up until 1982 when I left CBS. And 10 years later, when I was freelancing, he called me from Vegas. He said, listen, I need to do an album. You're the only one I can feel comfortable with, so will you do it? I said, I'd do anything for you. Just tell me when and where. And so I did. I did the album called Perfectly Frank, which was then a hit album and brought him back into the world. People started to hear him again, and he's been going crazy ever since. So, you know, it's a nice story.
Frank mentioned the abandoned Armenian church.
Yes,
and that may make a good segue for us to take up that important subject, and maybe also make a good segue for us for the first musical interlude of the evening, which we'll play without too much introduction, and enjoy this, and then talk a little bit more about, you know, where and how it was made and so on. As I said, the documentation of Columbia Legacy reissues is very detailed. This was a track that was recorded on March 21st, 1961 by Frank Laco between 2:30 and 5:30 p.m. at the Columbia 30th Street Studio. The band, Miles Davis, trumpet, John Coltrane, tenor saxophone, Wynton Kelly, piano, Paul Chambers, bass, Jimmy Cobb, drums. And this is a track called Tio, named no doubt for the producer of the session,
yes,
Tio Macero. Mike Metesky is a firm believer in avoiding fades, and I generally have got to go along with him on that. But on the other hand, I really wanted to play Tio for you guys, and yet it's kind of a long track. So what I think we'll do, Rick, is maybe fade it after the tenor saxophone solo, which is about 7 minutes. People who think modern jazz is kind of dry or academic or too far out for normal people or whatever should listen to Tio, I think. If you want just pure and infectious energy, I think this is an extraordinary track. And listen for the entrance of John Coltrane on tenor saxophone. I don't think there's any more electric moments in the history of acoustic jazz than a Coltrane entrance. But also, I mean, check this out for 1961, the work of Frank Laco in terms of just the clarity, the immediacy, the balance. I think you'll find it's pretty cool. You ready to go, Rick, with T.O., Miles Davis Quintet?
Yeah. haven't heard this in years. Choice. You hear the echo of that. It's the studio. It's not, yeah, the room itself. Thank you.
cut off Miles Davis, but we have some time constraints. The room
that was a great choice. That was a great choice, that piece of music.
I love that piece. The room that was recorded in is a very, very famous place called Columbia's 30th Street Studio. And by way of leading into to talking about that place with Frank, I wanted to offer a couple of quotes. I just discovered in reading about it that the hotel where I usually stay when I am in New York is called the Ramada Inn East Side. I discovered it a number of years ago. It's nothing too much, but it's relatively affordable by New York's insane standards. And I just discovered that it's one block exactly from where this studio used to stand. It's on 30th and Lexington. This studio was on 30th and 3rd. But I couldn't have gone and looked at it anyway. It was torn down in 1982, as we'll hear a little bit about. But it was a legendary place. There's a quote from David Simons, whose book Rick showed you. It's a really interesting book based on the excerpts I've read from it, and I want to read more. He says this, David Simons, in his book, Studio Stories, which is subtitled How the Great New York Records Were Made from Miles to Madonna, Sinatra to the Ramones. He says, I'd been a great admirer of Frank since I was a kid. I always loved the sound of those Columbia recordings. It took me years to figure out what it was about those records that sounded so great. It was the way Frank mic'd up that huge room at 30th Street Studio, and of course that incredible echo chamber sound on those vocal tracks. Frank was really one of the first to use natural room ambience and natural echo in a totally creative way. It was amazing because not only could Frank capture this big live element on tape, at the same time all the different instruments had this incredible clarity, as I think you just heard. One last quote from Mitch Miller, who was a very important producer for Columbia. Again, if you're old enough, you may remember his somewhat silly show on television and the sing-along with Mitch records and stuff. But he had another career as an A&R man in which he really was largely responsible for making Columbia the empire it was in pop music. And he said, I knew nothing about technique. I just tell Frank what I wanted to hear, and he'd invariably get it for me. So I would love to hear more, and I'm sure everyone else would, Frank, hear more about that particular studio where you did so much of your important work, and hear, you know, how'd you get it for him? How'd you get it for Mitch? I mean, we'd love to hear about really your setups, your mic placement, isolation, if any, room treatment, if any, the kind of equipment that you used. It was a special place for sure.
It was. That room was incredible. You mentioned Mitch. Mitch actually made the record business a necessary item in the American house. Before him, records were dull, you know, nothing exciting, but he's a classical musician, number one oboist, English horn. But here he was creating pop tunes and singers and arrangers, and that's when the industry started to grow. Now, that piece of Miles was a perfect piece to play if you were listening, and I'm sure you were. You heard the studio. There was no echo put on that tape. That was the studio itself, 100 by 100 by 100. It was incredible. And Mitch, to his credit, told CBS, because they were the parents, that this is what we want. And the second thing we want, we don't want corporate to get involved. I want the studio just as is. Dirt, dust, drapes, askew, and certainly don't want anybody coming in, wash and wax the floors and so forth. So if you agree to that, then we can sign a contract. And that's the way we went. It never changed. The day I left, it was still the same, except I shouldn't say that. 2 years before that, corporate came in. Mitch had retired, got out. They came in. I had the opportunity to be named the engineer for the first recording after it was all cleaned up and everything. And I set up my normal and I sat at the console and I'm listening and I'm saying to myself, it's not the same studio. It was incredibly different. So I very frankly told everybody what I thought. And that was the period of Clive Davis, and he and I never got along anyway, so that convinced me it's time to leave, and I did. But Mitch Miller was very creative and enthusiastic. I mean, all you had to do is mention you like to do something. Do it. Let me hear it. That's all I need. You know, that's what we would do. And I didn't even have to look at him to find out if he was happy, because he always was happy. And Mitch used to stand right behind me, always smoked those Cuban cigars. And my wife, we don't smoke. We never have, either one of us, and my children don't. And she'd be fast asleep when I come home late at night. She didn't wake up when I came in the door. It was the smell of cigar smoke all over my body that woke her up. So I told Mitch that one time. I said, geez, I'm sorry, but I'm comfortable doing it. I said, I didn't ask you to change. So, but no, he was, and when we started that sing along with Mitch, I thought, oh man, where's he going with this? But I give him credit. He stuck with it. He knew what he wanted. And the only thing he didn't know what he wanted was the sound. And that's where I came in. And we tried various mics and so forth, and separation and all that. And finally I said, Mitch, I would like an hour free. I'd like to reset the whole thing up and then get the musicians back in and all. Why? I said, because I think what we're doing is dull and I'd like to enhance it. Oh, okay. I figured he's going to complain. There's 25 voices. But he didn't. So he said, okay, when you're ready, let me know. So that's what we did. I went out the studio attendant. We changed everything. And I said, now I just need a few more minutes to get balanced, whatever. So he said, go ahead. So we did. We made a take, the same piece that we had stopped on. And we played one against the other. He looks at me, I can't answer. I said, there's nothing for me to say. You're right. That's what we want, and that's what we're going to get.
And this was a sing-along with Mitch album.
Yes.
So you got a male chorus there.
Yeah, 25 voices.
25 voices. Yeah. They were huge hits. I mean, they were absolutely...
They were.
Yeah. There were a series of them.
And the musicians. And then what you heard when it sold NBC to television, to NBC TV, the first night it went on, I'm listening. And about a third or fourth minute in, I was swearing, and then the phone rings. I knew who it was. Yeah, Mitch, what's happened? I said, Mitch, what we didn't tell NBC is to cut their limiters, because it was all being squashed. They had no life at all.
All compressed.
So the next day, of course, he called them, and we had to go over, and we talked them into it. Explained what the reasons were and so forth. So from then on, they always pull off the limiters and let it go. So that was fun. Listen, I could sit here all, you know, when I first was asked by that fellow there, going to have a few guys want to come in and want to hear you. And I thought, okay, well, why should I say no? But I wasn't feeling well. And since I'm feeling so well, I could do this another time if you want. I mean, I'm enjoying myself. I'm reliving my youth. And it's exciting.
You know, there's another quote from Simon's book that might prompt you into thinking of, you know, some of the actual methodology and stuff, I thought was an interesting quote. He says, Frank preferred to give each component of the orchestra its own microphone and track versus the classical approach of blending overhead mics above the entire orchestra. Thus, the strings, the horns, and the woodwinds each had their own track, as did the rhythm section of piano, bass, and drums. As Frank put it, even though we heard him say something at dinner about how he never uses bad language, as Frank put it, quote, no one was worried about isolation or any of that horseshit back then. But is that an accurate description of...
Absolutely. If there was one thing that I did differently, that was it. I never isolated. I refused to isolate. Music is music, and it's got to be absorbed by all instruments, not just a guitar here and a drummer there. You couldn't sell me on that, and I never did it. And now I told you what the size of that studio. I never isolated. If the only isolation I did was put a gobo in front of the bass drum, that was it. I had the guitar player right here. The bass player was right here. All the rhythm section was together. You have to hear music in order to play music. And that for me, that was my biggest accomplishment. And I fought. We talked about Tio. Tio had his way, not when I was doing that record, but after that one, he wanted everybody isolated. I mean, Miles never gave those musicians music. He just gave them a scratch sheet, and they just listened to each other, and they played it, and that's what makes music.
So you got to hear each other.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so if you're all ever going to go into it, remember that seriously. And I don't want you to think that I'm a hot shot, but that was the only difference I ever heard with the other engineers at CBS. They all did what the producers wanted, and they isolated. That's fine, but I couldn't do it. Couldn't.
But Frank, when you talk about isolation, and yet, in one sense, you were, it would seem, interested in demarcating and dealing with certain sections, I assume, into the channels that you had, in the way that is described here. Rather, I mean, you could have gone the full way, and hung a single mic overhead or something like that.
Oh yeah, sure. I had done that 2 years.
How are you getting those individual tracks on the sections of the orchestra, as he calls it?
Well, another thing I never did. I never listened to tracks, track. When I'm recording, when I was recording, I would be listening stereo, two track stereo, and balancing the music as I expected to hear it when it was mixed down to two track. So I was already mixing it, and so I'd never paid attention about tracks. That didn't interest me at all, and that's what I did. And you'll have to stop me if you want, because I get excited, and I probably talk too much.
No, not at all. There was another very well-known Columbia engineer named Roy Haley, who engineered Simon & Garfunkel recordings, so who sold several hundred million recordings in his time,
sure,
that he had engineered. He said that he was never comfortable recording in the 30th Street studio because of all that ambience, but he said Frank Laco had that room in his back pocket.
That's right, yeah. I had recorded Simon & Garfunkel.
Maybe that's another good segment. I'm sorry?
When they were called Tom and Jerry, I think, and... it was interesting, but I see, that's what they were doing, and that's what Roy Halley did. They took a year to make six
tracks, yeah,
pieces of music. I would have died in all that period of time. I absolutely refused to do it. I know he made a lot more money than I did, because he talked them into a package deal. I never paid any attention to that stuff. But they were great records once they got it out there. But
yeah. Well, Well, maybe that's a good segue to our second musical interlude here. It's amazing that the people Frank worked with. We heard Miles Davis. This next cut is by Thelonious Monk. You know, we're talking here about people that, these are the great artists of the 20th century, in my opinion. These are people on the level of Picasso and Joyce and people like that. And Frank worked with them intimately. This is a recording, fast forward 5.5 years to 1966, November 14th, 1966, also in the 30th Street Studio. This is a recording by the Thelonious Monk Quartet. He played for years and years with quartets with tenor saxophonist Charlie Rouse, a great tenor who was often described as his alter ego. The bass and drums rotated a lot over the years, always with very good players, but there were a number of different bassists and drummers. On this particular track, the bassist is Larry Gales, and the drummer is Ben Riley, who is still alive.
Yes.
And this is a track by Monk called Green Chimneys. Again, check out the power and the clarity with which this music is recorded.
This is also no music, just from the head.